In the author's note to his new collection of stories, The Greatest Jewish American Lover in Hungarian History, Michael Blumenthal provides his readers with an entertaining and enlightening mini-essay on what it means to write fiction in a world intent on finding the personal and the personally scandalous or titillating or embarrassing behind just about anything. Michael's defense, and he is a lawyer, of us fiction writers is at first blush a curious one. He calls us liars, as well as embellishers, exaggerators, and here's a nice noun, Your Honor, inventors. He draws a distinction between lawyers who need facts to reveal a particular truth and fiction writers who need lies to reveal a universal truth. He says Michael Blumenthal, the lawyer, and Michael Blumenthal, the fiction writer, bow to different gods. We could put that notion on trial now, turn this dais into a witness stand, appoint a prosecutor, nominate a bailiff. I see Kevin back there volunteering. But as Michael himself says, and his terrific collection of stories confirms, what's most interesting about excellent literature isn't the insights it might yield about the author's life, but the light it shines on all our lives. And the stories here, frank and insightful in their portraits of human desire and the joys and agonies associated with it, illuminate what we all have felt and wanted and longed for, even if we have admitted it to no one, not even to our own hearts. Michael is a visiting professor of law and co-director of the Immigration Clinic at the WVU College of Law. In addition to his prowess as a fiction writer, he is an internationally esteemed poet, the author of 8 poetry collections, and a radio star. It's a pleasure to introduce you tonight to Michael Blumenthal.
Thanks so much. And poor Mark, if he had known that his job description included having to introduce me every year or two, he would have probably taken the Yale job. Thank you all for coming. It's hard to compete with the Roosevelts. I almost stayed home for the Roosevelts, to tell you. But, when you're on the menu, you have to show up for dinner. But I really appreciate your coming. This is the first time in my life, this is kind of a loss of some literary virginity, the first time in my life I've ever read a story out loud. And even to my son, I didn't read stories out loud. I was thinking on the way over, actually, that poets have a real advantage. And, a poet gets like 10, 12, 15 at-bats, if he strikes out a couple times, he can still win the batting average, right? 333, 319. Fiction writer gets, short story writer gets 1 at-bat. And since I hate failure, I'm going to cheat, and I'm going to read a poem or two. Because this way, if you don't like the story, maybe you like, and I'm going to cheat further because I'm going to start by reading a little poem by someone else. Last time I read here, I first read a poem called Poem by Someone Else, but it was by me. This one is really by someone else. It's by my old friend, who sadly probably none of you have any more heard of. He was the poet, except you, and you. He was the poet laureate of the United States once upon a time, Howard Nemiroff. I don't know if he's familiar to any of you. And you! Forget it. I take it back. You've all heard of it. This is a little poem. He was a kind of moralist, and I'm a kind of closet moralist. I like moralists who don't brag about it. This is called Manners. I, for one, have very bad manners, and I'm not ashamed of it, but manners. Prig offered Pig the first chance at dessert. So Pig reached out and speared the bigger part. Now that, cried Prig, is extremely rude of you. Pig, with his mouth full, said, Well, what will you do? I would have taken the littler bit, said Prig. Stop kvetching, then. It's what you got, said Pig. So virtue is its own reward, you see, and that is all it's ever going to be. This is a poem of mine. It's called Stonehearted, and it has an epigraph from the French poet and critic Paul Valéry. And the epigraph is a very un-American epigraph. In America, you have to put everything on your T-shirt and your bumper sticker. But the epigraph reads, "Hide your God, for as he is your strength, in that he is your greatest secret. He is your weakness as soon as others know him." I like that. Stonehearted. I like working at a university where there's a building called Mineral Industries and another called Pharmaceutical Studies. It assures me there won't be too much poetry around, that I can wake and say to my beloved, "Hey, let's go check out some coal," instead of, "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways." It assures me I won't have my heart battered by too much sentiment, that I'll be able to live in peace with my private gods, with only a few miners and pharmacists to disturb me. Don't get me wrong, I like poetry well enough. I just want to keep it a private matter. Yesterday I went to the drugstore, then visited a mine. There was something poetic about it all. Today, no one harassing me with a sonnet of their own. I may write one myself. 14 lines rhyming A, B, A, B, and let the last two lines go wherever life takes them. Who knows? Maybe my poem will end with the words bauxite or gneiss. But if not, what the hell? Aspirin will do. Oh, now I can flunk out as a short story writer in peace, right? This book, I tried to put lawyer in the title, but somehow the greatest Jewish American lawyer, lover in Hungarian history just didn't make it with the publisher. But the muse of this book, I brought you the picture of the muse of this book, this little adorable woman. I don't know her last name. The only thing I know about her is that her name was Rachel, or is Rachel, and that this picture was taken in the summer of 1979. It's the only picture I took that summer. I don't know why, but that's an interesting thing. And the reason I say she's the muse of this book, she said something to me in that summer that I stuck with me, and I think somehow has to do with this book. We were at the Breadloaf Writers Conference, both scared out of our minds, you know, because we didn't know what the hell we were doing there or anywhere. And I asked her the typical stupid question you ask in that situation. I said, "What kind of poetry do you write?" And I mean, I think it's fair to say, without being a sexist, sexy is probably not the first word that comes to mind. She's adorable and sweet, but, you know. So I asked her, "What kind of poetry do you write?" And she looked me in the face and she said, "Bragging erotic." And believe it or not, that has stuck with me ever since, you know. And so that's why, in a way, this is called, this non-autobiographical book is called The Greatest Jewish American Lover in Hungarian History. I really didn't know what to read. I'd never done this before. I even on the way over, I really didn't have a clue what I was going to do, but I think I'll do this because maybe it would be the least boring to listen to. I think it's the oldest story in the book. It was written somewhere in the early 80s, I think. It's called They, an Anti-Romance. I think it'll become apparent why it's called an anti-romance. And it's in alternating sections entitled He and She. And I hope it's not too long. I really don't know how long. If you cough into your fists, I'll do something. The only thing that is true, the only thing that is true in the story or comes from reality is that the
actual lines that the student uses in this story were, in fact, used by a student, a creative writing student, a potential creative writing student at Harvard, and that was enough for me to want to write the story. So, one, he was trembling. He was trying to talk to her calmly, intimately, without seeming intimate, seductively, without seeming seductive. She was so much younger than he, young enough to be his daughter, old enough to be his lover. There were, after all, couples like them all over Paris, Prague, the Upper West Side. From the moment she had walked into his office, he had been trembling. And now, as he very deliberately sat munching on his salad across from her in the semi-dark restaurant, he used his questions like surgical tools, prying, cleaving, exploring the dark interstices and openings. He'd been very unhappy, he realized, for some time now. He always realized it when, as now, he felt that some incipient happiness confronted him. How he hated his goodness, his forced virtue and sentimentality. How he hated his marriage, the constricted habitual life that had lured him into. And now she was sitting there across from him, not an escape exactly, but an ellipse. An ellipse back into the lost life of his passions and desires. That she was beautiful, there was no doubt. Not beautiful inexactly, as a poet had once written, beautiful exactly. Not in the cold, evasive, untouchable guise beauty so often insulated itself with, but in a way that was vulnerable, open, confused. As confused, perhaps, as he was confused. It seems to me these days that sexual energy drives most things, she wrote in the brief essay she submitted to get into his class. It adds an instant zesty flavor like a shake of accent to an otherwise ordinary scene. And now they were seated here in this otherwise ordinary scene, the lower half of his body trembling so violently beneath the table that every morsel in his mouth seemed suddenly infused with that same zesty flavor. We might try, for example, he said, to write about this lunch we're having. We might each try to write about what we thought the other was thinking. She smiled. We might try writing it now, he went on, right after we leave here. But we wouldn't have much distance from it. It would probably be muddled, confused, lacking in clarity. Yes, she said, it probably would. Or we could try it tomorrow after having slept on it. That might be better. Yes, she said, that might be better. Now it was tomorrow. He was no longer trembling, but he hadn't slept. He'd gone home after their lunch and placing a large pillow over the spot where his wife slept on their king-sized bed, scattered the seed of his desire and loneliness all over the pillow, exhausting his nervousness and his trembling. Then, for a few short moments before going back to his office, he fell asleep. Two, she. She felt confused, uncertain. She liked the way he had smiled at her when she entered his office, like the poem he had read about his grandfather that day at the first class meeting. He made her feel immediately comfortable, offering her the chair and sitting at her feet on his office porch beneath the orangish maple. She was used to men finding her beautiful, younger men, older men, men she had thought of only as her friends. When I got to America, she wrote in her little essay, I taught my kindergarten class kissing games. The girls always chased the boys, pinned them down, and raped them. She wondered if her little essay had excited him, given him the wrong idea. She was being serious, of course, and honest, because that was the point, wasn't it? To be honest. And she didn't want, she really didn't want to always be the victim of her beauty. She didn't want for beauty to become a wound, as a teacher had once told her it had been in the Irish folktale, Deirdre of the Sorrows. She was glad to be beautiful.
but she didn't want to be the archetypal, tragic, beautiful mulatto. No, she didn't want to live that life. Her father had been a kind of a free love type from the 60s, a Norwegian psychologist who met her mother while studying at Stanford. He believed kids should be aware, she had written in her essay. Now she wondered if he too, seated across from her, had been a free love type in the 60s. She wondered what he looked like naked, if his body was still young, what he might teach her. She wondered if her little essay had excited him. So sex, in a sense, is the meaning of life, her essay had ended. She wondered if that was right. Was that all there is? She wondered if he, old enough to be her father, though he didn't look it, still thought so too. She wondered what happened to the meaning of life when you were married, when sex became a habit, or possibly disappeared. 3, he. He wondered what he should do with his desire. The difference between desire and action in Jacques Lacan was the title of a lecture he'd been invited to at the Center for Literary Studies. But what was the difference between desire and action? What should it be for him? Aside from squandering his seed all over his marital pillow, what should he do with his desire now? The truth will set you free, the old proverb went. But what truth, to his knowledge, had ever set anyone free? He was sick of proverbs anyway. Should he take her for a walk along the river, say to her, "Listen, I'm so helpless with desire for you, I don't know what to do about it." Should he hope, as the advice givers love to write in the advice columns, that desire could be transmogrified to friendship? Should he content himself with the abstract wisdom that unfulfilled desire endured, whereas fulfilled desire expired and turned sour? I held out my hand for a shake, but found myself grabbing his ribcage and hugging him firmly, she wrote in the second piece she submitted, a short story. When I let him go, I got a good look at his face. He should have been my father, I thought. He could have been her father, he realized. Then he wouldn't have been sitting there, trembling, desiring her. But he already was a father. Thank God he hadn't had a daughter. But what if he were to wind up desiring his own son? He had such beautiful little feet, his son, such soft skin. He had had such a student once, a student whose father desired him, a student of his he'd taught in his year at a mental institution in upstate New York. He imagined himself inside and out of her. He imagined his tongue, the taste of her, the scent. He imagined every possible circumnavigation of her body, everything he could teach her, or had she already been taught? I was the straightest, squarest member of my 10th grade class, she had written. I wore blazers and button-down shirts to school, and I was a member of the Junior Statesmen of America. But I managed to get the largest, most smack-talking and womanizing jock on the football team as my first boyfriend. This was a dichotomy I loved. Everyone wondered if we had done it, but neither of us would tell. He was wondering, too, if they had done it. He was wondering what she had done, with whom, when, how. Did anyone ever get enough of love? Hadn't Yeats written, "No man has ever lived that had enough of children's gratitude or women's love"? Wasn't he right? What possible happiness could yet one more add? She, 4. She knew she was still young, that anything could happen to her, that it would all be part of experiencing life. He too could be part of her experiencing life. "Live while you can," her father had urged her when she visited him in Oslo last spring, "or you'll only regret it later. Harvest experience." He didn't look happy, she thought. He moved his face a bit too close to hers when he talked. He looked so hungry, starved in fact. But he was nice, smart, vaguely handsome. He had, she was sure, things to teach her. He must have things to teach her, about books, about life.
I'm kind of glad you're not going to be in my class, he said to her when they first sat down. It makes it easier to be friends. But what did he mean by friends? What kind of a friendship would a man his age, a man with a wife and child, want from her? What kind of friendship would she want from him? 5. He. The sleek, expensive girls I teach, he remembered the poet's lines, younger and pinker every year, bloom gradually out of reach. Had she bloomed out of reach? Teaching is just plain and simple, a sexy thing to do, he offered, abandoning all subtlety. When two people talk about what really matters to them, when two people open themselves up to what's intimate and personal and important, well, it's not that easy to keep any one part of themselves entirely closed off. Mm-hmm, she nodded. Mm-hmm. 6. She. She was thinking there really wasn't much difference among people from between about 20 and 50. They all seemed to be struggling with the same stuff. Love, career. He looked young to her. No gray hair. Such questing personal eyes. Was he lost too, she wondered. Was he as confused as she was? He. She seemed so calm, poised, so sure of herself. Was it beauty that had made her that way? Was it luck? The first rule of life, Oscar Wilde had written, adopt a poise. What the second one is, no one has yet discovered. Why wasn't he better at adopting a poise? The self-confident professor, the secure intellectual. Why wasn't he better at being happy, at enjoying his wife and his family, at mourning his lost youth, his unlived life, and just getting on with it? She. It was time to get her measles vaccination. They had been sitting at lunch for almost 2 hours. I don't usually like to eat lunch, he had said on their way to the restaurant. It screws up the rest of my day. He helped her on with her coat, lingering over her shoulder. He insisted on paying the check, though it made her a bit uncomfortable. Next time, he said, making her feel both hopeful and frightened, you can pay. They walked out into the square. It was raining. He nudged his umbrella gently rightward so as to cover both their heads. Thanks, she said, reaching out her hand as she began to turn in the opposite direction. I had a really nice time. He didn't quite know what he would do with the rest of his day. He was beginning to feel, as she turned to walk in the opposite direction, nervous, like a young boy at the end of an unrequited first date. He allowed the umbrella to linger a bit too far to the right of him, covering him with rain. Yes, he said, as her face began to turn away from his. I had a nice time, too. He turned to face the oncoming cars in the street. Rarely had he felt so confused, so restless, so entirely alone. She found herself hardly thinking of him anymore a few days later. She'd been to New York to see her boyfriend. They'd had a wonderful time. Yes, he cried when he came inside her. Yes, yes. Her boyfriend had such a beautiful body. They had had such fun dancing at various New York discotheques, drinking, listening to Cole Porter, making love. I want you to come to New York and live with me after you graduate, he said the next morning over breakfast. Yes, she said. Yes, I will. What could she possibly have wanted with a man old enough to be her father? A man with a wife and child, she wondered. Her life, after all, was just beginning, and his, well, he was off somewhere else, no doubt in some dark, ambiguous mid-terrain. She'd felt a kind of sick, for days, in fact, after her measles vaccination, but now she felt better. She'd always loved the New England fall, the trees turning such glorious colors, the leaves falling. It made her think of hot chocolate and sweaters, of things that were warm and consoling.
And now, with nothing much else to do on a crisp, cold, late afternoon October, she thought she'd get herself some. She put on her fur hat and gloves. What a perfect afternoon, she thought, for a cup of hot chocolate. He'd looked into his wife's face, into her eyes again last night for the first time in a long while. She was beautiful, he realized, as though he had never seen her before. More beautiful, in fact, than when they had first met. More weathered, more wizened, more full of his life. And his son, what a beautiful child. What flesh and blood. He'd been nervous for days after their lunch, nervous, distracted, even depressed. The ways we miss our life, that awful, terrifying line from the poet Randall Jarrell kept coming to him. The ways we miss our life, our life. For days he'd walked around daydreaming, lustful, restless, beleaguered. But now he was calm again. His unhappiness, he realized, was only the unhappiness of life itself, the unhappiness of being contained in a single body. He walked from his office toward Harvard Square. The leaves were fluttering, bright yellow and orange from the maples around him. I'm going to die, he thought to himself rather cheerfully. One day, I'm going to die. He loved those late autumn afternoons, the air crispening, the light slanting towards melancholy and darkness. They always made him want something warm and consoling inside him, like the warm milk and honey his mother had given him as a child, like hot cocoa. Why not, he thought, buy himself something warm to drink before going back home to his wife and son, back to the consoling warmth of his own home. Whistling to himself, he passed a young woman in a fur hat, her hair braided to both sides in a ponytail, her skin the color of warm cocoa. She was kind of pretty, he thought as they passed. She looked, he realized a short while later, vaguely familiar. 12, she. Dear M, you didn't seem to recognize me yesterday when we passed on the street. Maybe it was because of the fur hat I was wearing. Or else you simply didn't want to talk. And I was feeling a bit too shy to intrude on what seemed to be your reveries. But I was wondering if we might get together again for lunch or a drink before I leave for the summer. I'm going to New Orleans to live with my boyfriend, who just got a gig playing jazz before we moved to New York. There are so few professors I feel I've had even the slightest chance to interact with on a more personal level during my years here, and you seem like one of the few who's truly accessible to and interested in students. And I'm truly sorry I haven't had time to be in touch again before this. It's been a busy year. So give me a call if you've got a free hour or so sometime soon, or else I'll just surprise you and drop by your office, okay? Looking forward to seeing you. H. He. Dear H, thanks so much for lunch. You didn't need to treat, really, but I thoroughly enjoyed myself anyway. Since you'll never be a student of mine, a fact about which I must confess I'm not sorry, and since the enclosed piece is a kind of collaboration between us, and since it was you who reminded me so aptly that, quote, sexual energy drives most things, unquote, I thought I would take the risk of sharing the enclosed little story I wrote last fall with you, my co-author. Hope you like and aren't offended by it. Being a person who came of age in the late back 60s, I suppose, still allows me to do this sort of thing, my slightly graying hair notwithstanding. See you again before you leave, huh? Cheers, M. She. M. I find your story highly inappropriate to have sent me to read. Apparently, you have severely misinterpreted my friendliness towards you last semester and over the last couple of weeks. In no way did I come on to you. Certainly, you did not know me well enough to have sent me that story, even if I had. I found it very intrusive, and in fact consider it to be a form of sexual harassment, the kind you so ironically downplayed when we spoke last week. Since you seem not to understand why, I will outline the reasons for you, for your future reference. One, I came to you in a professional capacity as a writing teacher, and although we discussed personal issues and the short story I submitted to you dealt with personal issues, you should have responded to me in the vein in which I approached you. Two, the nature of the issues I wrote about last semester in no way gave you the right to exploit information about me that they revealed, and in fact should have made you all the more careful not to violate my confidence. Three, if you are so dedicated to cultivating open, friendly relations with members of the university community, particularly students, you must take care to maintain an environment of trust in the process. I feel you abused your position as a teacher in leading me to believe that you wished to advise me and help me as a writing student, and then pursuing other agendas of your own. The letter you sent me disturbed me and will leave me sadly a lot more cautious in approaching other teachers for advice. I also do not want any more contact with you. I sincerely hope you do not act in the same way toward other female students in the future, though I am willing to let this matter drop and simply stop contact with you. Such incidents with other women students could leave you very vulnerable professionally. Yours, H. 15. He. Dear H, it seems sadly for me at least that you radically misinterpreted both my story and my reasons for sending to you, which makes me feel both sad and sorry. I sent you the story because truly I felt we were friends, and I trusted you to take it as it was written, as a work of imagination based loosely on two characters, you and I, but in its emotional fantasies and internal workings not at all equal or reducible to either. This, I must tell you, as I would as a teacher, as I will as a friend, is exactly what writers must do, and what actual people, professors, married men, students, etc., certainly should not, or at least ought to do their damnedest to avoid. I wrote this story because our lunch, along with your submission from my class, triggered a certain writerly, though I must repeat, not all that autobiographical fantasy in me. Fantasy of what might occur between a certain not-so-old college writing professor and a certain not-so-young student, and of how such fantasies might evolve, seen from an interior perspective. This, believe it or not, is what I, and every writer I know, do in all my writing. We begin with actual characters, a few known events, and then allow whatever fantasies may come, fantasies I know to be at least partially true from my experience of myself and others, to take over those characters and give them an imaginary, I repeat, imaginary life. You and anyone else who reads or writes ought to realize there is, thank God, a radical difference between what a person may be inspired to write on paper and what an actual human being ought, in his or her life, to do. In fact, one of the great ways in which literature has traditionally instructed us is not by being politically correct, but by being emphatically politically incorrect, by showing us precisely how we ought not to live and what are the costs of so living. See, for example, Anna Karenina or Crime and Punishment. The actual me is, in fact, a quite happily married, non-messing around with students type of guy who has a very clear sense of certain boundaries and their non-violation. The actual you, to be sure, in no way, or at least in no overt way, came on to me as I, in real life, certainly knew. But as a writer, repeat, as a writer,
The possibilities inherent in our story and our lunch were, well, how else can I say it, rather irresistible. And as is my writerly duty, I made of them on paper what I could. Perhaps stupidly I trusted too much in your mature ability to make these kinds of distinctions. And as I thought it at best unlikely that I would ever see you again, I felt there was no harm in sharing what I considered happily a kind of collaboration, which I felt it would be unfair to undertake further without at least showing it to you. Even my fictional character, you must realize, has the good sense to know at the end that such fantasies are largely the product of a middle-aged mind afraid of death and groundedness. And his real-life creator, believe it or not, knows it as well. So, how many mea culpas shall I utter here in order to satisfy you? I'm simply sorry that you took this rather than as an act of trust, as an act of harassment. And I have certainly learned from this that I need to be more cautious about any such relationship with students, imaginary or real. But you should know, what I've told you here is in no way any different than what I would stand by as a writer, teacher, advisor, mentor, friend, etc. in any other circumstance. I had and have no other agendas with you than trying to be friendly and helpful. If in doing so I may have stumbled across a story of my own, I can only perhaps regret, but not feel guilty for. In fact, were we not now about to go our separate ways into the adult world, I certainly would never ever have shown you the story to begin with. But I assumed wrongly that you would take it for what it is, a work of fiction. If you'd care to talk about this some more, I'd certainly be glad and eager to. If not, I can only say I'm sorry, and I must confess, a tad surprised and hurt to have had my intentions and my very being so radically misunderstood. In any event, I wish you better than just well in New Orleans this summer and whatever you do in the future. Perhaps someday soon you'll be able to see the truthfulness of what I've said here, and that literature, though it may sometimes be better than life, is certainly, thank God, not always equal to it. Yours sincerely, M. She wondered if indeed he had been right. Had she reacted too quickly, too emotionally? Had he really meant nothing more by showing her his story than to honor their friendship, to show his consideration of her as an equal? Maybe she shouldn't have shown the story to her friend Molly. What a horny, disgusting son of a bitch he is, she had said on reading it. To begin with, maybe she should merely have sat on her feelings, her perhaps childish reaction of anger and betrayal. Now she felt a certain sadness enter her, a certain sadness for him as well as for herself, as she packed her bags to leave Cambridge, perhaps forever. It must be difficult, she suddenly thought to herself, being still fairly young and spending your time teaching bright, beautiful students, many of them on their way to a success and glory much greater than your own. Young people who were blooming, as he had once put it, perpetually out of reach. It must be difficult to be married, to be tied down, settled, responsible, yet still hungry, still yearning. She had liked his face, something about his openness and vulnerability from the moment she'd first seen him. Maybe even she had felt a flicker of desire, of curiosity about what it would be like to be with a man his age, a man of his background and experience. She had, after all, been with older men before, men from whom she'd learned something, men whose attachment to her, even within the distorting revisions of memory, she still treasured and looked upon fondly. And she knew, of course, that she didn't like to exploit the fact, though she didn't like to exploit the fact, that she was beautiful.
She'd been told too often, had studied her own face in the mirror too repeatedly, not to believe it. And she herself loved beauty, physical beauty, the beauty of beautiful words, the beauty of maples in early spring, as well as anyone else did. Maybe she should write to him again, she thought to herself. Maybe she should stop by his office one more time before leaving. Life, after all, was so strange, so mixed, so incapable of any clear, unambiguous understanding. Wasn't that, after all, what college, what literature had ultimately tried to teach her? 17, he. Packing his bags to leave Cambridge, perhaps forever, he felt badly. He had, of course, desired her, and who could blame him? She was, after all, beautiful, exactly. But he had also behaved honorably, decently. He had never touched her, never made any overt suggestions, had done nothing to compromise his relationship with her as a potential teacher, even as a friend. Yes, of course, he had taken parts of her letters, her conversation, and made them his own. He had used them in his so-called story. But wasn't that as he had tried to explain to her what writers were supposed to do? Wasn't that what all these years he'd been trying to teach his students? Wasn't this merely an example of that very tactful and considerate theft from actual life that a writer in his or her work had to insist on claiming the right to? And wasn't it no less than T.S. Eliot himself who had said that good poets borrow, great ones steal? Life, he once again realized as he packed his books into boxes, was hopelessly complicated, hopelessly resistant to quick moralizing and easy answers. So why not, as a poet he admired once suggested, merely enjoy the freedom of knowing that scope eluded his grasp, that there was no finality of vision, that neither he nor anyone else was capable of perceiving anything completely. An almost paralyzing sadness coursed through him as he sealed the last carton with masking tape and sat, possibly for the last time, watching the late light sift through the trees behind his office patio. Soon the days would grow shorter once more, just as his life daily was growing shorter as well. Soon, yet another time, he would have to begin again.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Thank you all for coming.
If somebody wants to ask a question, I like having a conversation. It feels like a monologue. But if somebody wants to, there's a question.
Do you think that sense of catharsis only can come from a writing that is so close to home and reality?
I missed the very first part of your question.
If there was a sense of catharsis once you wrote the story and it made him appreciate his life more, and do you think that can only come from a writing that is so close to reality?
Uh-huh. What's your name?
Chris.
Chris. Well, you know, I think there are kind of two kinds of writers, you know. The ones I identify most with are the ones for whom writing is a kind of cathartic process that has to do with somebody, with your emotional reality, if not your factual reality. I think there are writers, and for even these writers, I think it's true, but there are other writers like John Irving would be an example, who just have an incredible imagination and live in a world, can sort of create worlds that, while they resonate with something internal, are sort of out there, you know. I have no imagination. I mean, I'm a complete idiot. You know, I used to try to read stories to my son, and I would go, you know, once upon a time, there was I get to three sentences, and then he'd look at me, okay, Dad, what next? And there'd be this enormous silence because I couldn't think of what was, you know, when I tried to make one up. So
I, for better or worse, I kind of got stuck with my life, for my subject in some ways, but really not in the ways people, as Mark said in his introduction, not in the ways people like to assume. You know, everybody's looking for, did you really do this? You know, and you can believe it or not, but I didn't, you know. In my novel, which is somewhat autobiographical, the protagonist screws a student in the stacks of Widener Library. Never has... Unfortunately, all the sex in my novel is invented. But, you know, and most of the sex in this book. But anyway, does you know... I think that Danica wants to ask a question. No, I'm kidding. Does that... I mean, I think sometimes there is a... Especially, I think, when you're younger, when I started writing. I remember the first poem I ever wrote that I thought was a real poem, not just hitting it against the wall. And it was about my grandmother. And the last lines of it, she was blind or something like, and now still your lesson, only those who will touch can see me. Only those who are deaf will listen. Only the blind reach out to find me. And I remember when I wrote that line, I started to sob. So I
think early in your career, because it was an insight about how I felt emotionally, that she was the only person who had loved me and she couldn't see me. And but even now I cry. But I think... that happens less when you get older. All that stuff has been dredged out, you know, a lot of it. But thank you for the question. Do you really have a question, or are you just joking with me?
This is my friend who went, yeah.
If you say that writing is betraying oneself.
Is betraying oneself.
Yeah. You would feel like this story is a kind of betraying teachers.
I missed a little of. Do I feel that this story is a betrayal of?
Betraying teachers who sometimes have feelings for their students.
You mean, was I in some ways using, betraying the student or myself? It's an old question, you know. I mean, all the saying, anybody who wants to be safe shouldn't get involved with a writer, blah, 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 blah. You know, I mean, that's what writers do, and I think every writer has their own sort of ethical standards. I'll give you an example, actually, from this book. And it was a big thing, actually, that just happened. There's a story in this book, the first story, and it is based on something that happened. It's called Three Beds. Something that happened to a Hungarian friend and neighbor of mine, a very good friend. But it was irresistible as a subject. It was just irresistible. I mean, for a writer, you couldn't let this go. And so I wrote it. And I right away made a point. I didn't know what I would do with it, if anybody would ever read it, or, you know, but I made a point right away of setting it in another country, Israel. Changing the profession, changing, you know, everything I could change except the emotional content of the story. And it was published in some international journal, I forget, international something. It's in here, but I can't remember. And then a couple of months ago, the galleys came to my house. And my wife, who had read the story, I think, in an earlier version, read it, and I said, she went to bed and took my book, and I was very curious how she liked it. So I said, how'd she like? And she looked at me and she said, if you publish this, you can forget about them as friends. And I just became like ill, physically ill, because I had thought about it and what I had put together, and I think correctly, but it was that
A, they would never see this book, which, unless I give it to them, and I'm not gonna, that they would never see this book. They, you know, and B, nobody would from the story identify them. And the only people who could identify them from the story would be people who already knew the story, of which there were very few, some intimates who knew the story.
So I thought, is there some opportunity for betrayal? You know, could I hurt them? You know, now, it's true that I never want them to see it. But I even talked about it with Mark,
I believe, over lunch one day, didn't we? Yeah.
So, you know, you always make those decisions, like the poet Robert Lowell was viciously criticized for the way he wrote about his wife, Elizabeth Hartwick, in some of his poems, and even other poets thought it was. So, you know, the betrayal question, I mean, everybody does what they can sleep with, you know. I mean, I think I did the right thing. But actually, my wife got me so upset that I called the publisher and said, take it out. And they said, sorry, the train has left the station. You know, I literally used that word. But I would have rather than risk hurting a friend just forgotten the whole book, you know. But I tried to do the right thing. Yeah, Jim. Little subsections.
The next to last between the letter and the very last between music, if I understood correctly. I don't think we like them when we hear the last two letters. I think we like getting
her letter to him and his letter.
Right. I don't like either of them.
You don't like the characters.
I don't like either of them.
Uh-huh.
Because she seems disingenuously innocent.
Uh-huh.
And he seems disingenuously self-excusing.
Uh-huh.
Then with each of the musings, you seem to save them a little.
Uh-huh.
Because she
uh-huh.
says, well, maybe I did flirt a little. And
right.
he says,
maybe I did disaster.
Her.
Right, right.
Is that struggle with honesty central to what you're trying to do?
I think so. You know, it's hard for me to say what I tried to do there because I never try to do anything. I just write. I'm not thinking I'm going to try to do this. I don't think like that. But I think that the story is a lot about honesty and self-delusion and, you know, right artistic conduct versus human contact. And I suppose both those letters, they are somewhat unlikable. I mean, I agree with you. And they're kind of, I wouldn't say meant to be, because I'm not that calculating, but I think they're a little bit unlikable for the reasons you said. You know, that, and that's, I hope that's what the story is kind of about, this struggle between desire and morality and goodness and rightness and institutional behavior and private behavior, you know, all that stuff. That's still very much with us. Yeah.
I'm curious about your
process. I forgot your first name.
Oh, Micah.
Micah, that's close.
I'm curious about your process of just writing. I was at a university and I had this experience as an internship at the College of Education. And I was so self-righteous with the professor saying that I had the experience that I didn't write about.
You were so self-righteous as a professor?
No, as a student.
Oh, uh-huh.
As a graduate student. And I said, I've already had the experience. I'm not going to write about it.
Right.
Because
right.
I hated writing.
Uh-huh.
And he said, you're going to write about it. And the process of writing caused me to view it through a different lens.
Right.
But writing for me is a struggle. And listen to writers and there's no such thing as writer's block. So I'm curious about the process of writing for yourself.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's radically changed over the years. Radically, radically, radically. Because when I was starting out, I mean, I'm not saying this to be self-aggrandizing, but you know, I was truly obsessed. I mean, I felt like I was just taking dictation from the muse, and I had to write, and I went to the park every morning at 5 and wrote till 8 and then wrote on my lunch hour. Didn't pay attention to girls much. And that went on for numbers of years, really. And it's very great because you don't have a choice. When you have a passion like that, you have no choice. Now I have a choice. So it's very different. I really live by the pleasure principle. I try never to do something that is not a pleasure. So I write when it gives me pleasure, which is not that often, thank God. That's why there's 13 stories in 25 years, you know. I think everybody's different, you know. Everybody's different, you know. Some people, you know, who is it who said a writer is somebody for whom writing is harder than for anybody else? Who said that?
Thomas Mann.
That's right. Thank you. Always somebody you can count on in the audience. You know, and some people, I'm not like that. But I think everybody, there's so many different ways to do this or not do it. I don't do it much anymore. I'd rather read somebody who's better than I am. Thank you all. Thanks to Mark. Thanks to Mark for the 3 books. Thank you. Thank you very much. Do you want this creature? Yeah.